You are listening to an ADIS podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the ADIS Rapid Plus podcast series. Joining us today is Professor Nick Oliver from the Imperial College London. Today, we'll be discussing the topic of real-world data for glucose sensing technologies and type 1 diabetes. So, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this podcast, where we'll be talking about the advancement of home glucose monitoring and its application in this field via real-world data. We'll touch upon the advantages and pitfalls of using real-world data and discuss key examples of these data sets and how real-world data might shape the future of glucose sensing. So, first things first, how far has glucose monitoring come, Nick? I'm really interested to know a bit more about the history of this technology and how it first came about.
Thanks very much for inviting me to do this. So glucose monitoring has been a cornerstone of self-management of diabetes, and in particular type 1 diabetes, really dating back well into the 1980s and even before. Before the 1980s, it was mostly focused on urine testing. So people would measure urine at home with a complicated bit of home chemistry, and they would do that intermittently, looking at whether or not they had fasting glycosuria. The 1980s changed that with the ability to start measuring glucose on capillary blood samples initially in the clinic, and then that transferred fairly quickly to the home. These were fairly big devices that relied on colorimetric technologies and used a reasonable volume of blood and took up to 10 minutes or even longer to give a result. But over time, as always happens, things became smaller, required a much smaller volume of blood and provided more accurate results more quickly. And certainly since the 1990s, we've had a standard care of self-monitoring of blood glucose in type 1 diabetes, as well as in insulin-treated type 2 diabetes and for anyone with type 2 diabetes at high risk of hypoglycemia. Since 1999, we've had continuous glucose monitoring technologies available to us. These started off as being wired devices that recorded glucose over 3 days and then had to be downloaded. But again, over time, have become smaller, more accurate, the sensors last longer, and they now provide real-time continuous glucose information to the user, which can be looked at by healthcare professionals or carers.
Oh, so it really has come a long way then, I suppose, with technology in general. So as there are so many options available for patients, could you maybe talk us through the key ones that are in circulation right now?
Yeah, sure. So there are broadly three categories of continuous glucose sensors that we have available to us for care of all diabetes, but in particular type 1 diabetes. These are real-time continuous glucose monitoring, which gives the user a real-time glucose value, along with the rate and direction of change of glucose and the preceding few hours of glucose trend. And that's available either on a receiver or on a smartphone device and gives the user that real-time information whenever they wish to see it. Real-time devices also give alerts and alarms for either impending or established hypo and hyperglycemia, or if glucose is very rapidly changing. The second implementation of continuous glucose data is flash glucose monitoring, or what's sometimes called intermittently scanned continuous glucose monitoring. And that doesn't give real-time values, but instead relies on the user swiping their device, so that's either the receiver or the smartphone, over the sensor to give them the information. And the alerts and alarms are either not present at all with intermittently scanned continuous monitoring, or they're qualitative alarms. And what that means is, rather than giving you the immediate alarm and the information around the alarm, it tells you that something has happened that requires a swipe to look at what the alarm status is. And then finally, there's blinded continuous glucose monitoring, where the user can't see any of the values. And at the end of the sensor session, the data are downloaded for review. That's used far less frequently in clinical practice, but can be a very useful research tool. So continuous glucose monitors don't measure blood. They measure interstitial fluid glucose, so the glucose in the fluid underneath the skin. And they report frequently sampled glucose values, and that's between every 1 minute to every 15 minutes or so. Most of them are around the 5 minute mark, so that gives you 288 glucose values per day, and they enable you to make clinically meaningful changes to your self-management on a reasonably regular basis.
That's fantastic. It seems like there really are so many options available to us. it must be quite difficult to work out which one might be best. As we know, these have developed so much in the past 20 years because of technological advancements, but also because of randomized controlled trials, which have been crucial in building up the robust evidence base. So could you actually talk us through some of the key evidence that's come out of these clinical trials?
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, making a choice about which technology is most appropriate in a clinical scenario is really important. And that choice should be an informed choice between the clinician and the person who's going to be using the device. So if we think about those three categories, I'll park blinded CGM because it's really not frequently used, as I said, in clinical practice. So there's not a great evidence base for that recently, but if we think about real-time continuous glucose monitoring, there's a fantastic evidence base, particularly over the last 10 years or so, which tells us that real-time continuous glucose monitoring can significantly reduce HbA1c in young people, older adults, and adults with living with type 1 diabetes. And importantly, real-time continuous glucose monitoring can do that irrespective of whether you use an insulin pump or a multiple dose injection regimen. Along with the reduced HbA1c, real-time monitoring reduces exposure to hypoglycemia at all thresholds. So the International Hypoglycemia Study Group suggested that everyone should use a threshold of less than 3.0 millimoles per liter or 54 milligrams per deciliter as the threshold for important hypoglycemia. And CGM certainly reduces exposure to all thresholds, including that one. And really importantly, for people at highest risk of severe hypoglycemia requiring the assistance of a third party for active treatment, real-time continuous glucose monitoring can reduce the incidence of those severe episodes. And that's really important because they can be incredibly disabling and they're associated with morbidity and mortality. Continuous glucose monitoring also reduces glucose variability, and these changes to glucose, these improvements to overall glucose and glucose below target happen during the day and during the night. The CONCEPT study showed that real-time continuous glucose monitoring used by pregnant women living with type 1 diabetes can reduce adverse materno-fetal outcomes, and that included neonatal intensive care unit admissions for the newborn, neonatal hypoglycemia, and the length of stay for the baby. And in terms of how people live with type 1 diabetes and the psychosocial outcomes or the patient-reported outcomes, real-time continuous glucose monitoring can reduce hypoglycemia fear, and in particular the worry aspect of the hypoglycemia fear score, and can increase treatment satisfaction. Flash glucose monitoring has a slightly smaller evidence base, but can reduce exposure to hypoglycemia below 3.9 millimoles per litre or 70 milligrams per deciliter. Again, can increase treatment satisfaction. And until recently, flash glucose monitoring didn't have an evidence base for a reduction in HbA1c compared with self-monitoring blood glucose. The IMPACT study, which was the main randomized controlled trial in type 1 diabetes, didn't show a change in HbA1c. But the Flash UK study, which has just been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, showed that the FreeStyle Libre 2 device, which is an intermittently scanned continuous glucose monitoring device with qualitative alarms, can reduce HbA1c compared with self-monitored blood glucose. As I said at the start, it's really important to be able to make an informed choice about which monitoring technology is most appropriate. And there are three studies that have pitched these, both flash and real-time continuous glucose monitoring, in a head-to-head study. One of these, the iHeart CGM study, did that in very high-risk people, so people with impaired awareness of hypoglycemia or previous severe hypoglycemia. And then there was the Corrida study and the ALERT T1 study, which were larger and less selective populations. And really interestingly, all three showed exactly the same thing, which is that real-time continuous glucose monitoring had a significantly greater beneficial impact on glucose outcomes than flash glucose monitoring. So it's really down to informed choice, person preference, and what you're trying to achieve with your continuous glucose monitoring technology.
That's so interesting that they all have such similar results. It's clear that these clinical trials have given us a lot of information, which has been crucial in informing clinical practice. But it can't really be ignored that there must be some blind spots from these clinical trials just because they're in such a controlled environment. So what do these clinical trials actually not tell us about these technologies? What are these gaps?
Absolutely. So doing clinical trials is great, and we have a really controlled environment and we can very carefully and closely look at outcomes. But inevitably, the people that we recruit as participants to randomized controlled trials may not entirely be reflective of the population that live with type 1 diabetes. So if we think about the selection bias of randomized controlled trials, it can sometimes be difficult to get a diverse representative population. And by diverse, I mean in terms of age groups, in terms of ethnicity, and in terms of socioeconomic deprivation, particularly. And obviously, these are really important. We know that people who live in an environment where there is deprivation are at higher risk of adverse outcomes living with diabetes. So it's crucial that we recruit these people if possible so that we can see the benefits or not in that group. Inevitably, we always do clinical trials in academic centres, so centres that have both clinics and also people who do clinical research. And that means that we can have a slightly skewed population. And we're not always great in randomised controlled trials at looking at outcomes that are important to people living with diabetes. I just listed a load of glucose outcomes and only a couple of patient-reported outcomes. But of course, if you live with type 1 diabetes for decades, it's really important how you live with that and your experience of living with it. So it's very useful to look at clinical and cost effectiveness from randomized controlled trials, but it doesn't tell you the lived experience of a technology, and it doesn't tell you what the real world change might be for someone who is less selected and who has less education, less support at the outset.
Yeah, they're really important points, which I suppose now brings in our key theme of the podcast today, which is real world data. Could these data help fill these gaps? Why is real world data so important?
Yeah, absolutely. I think real world data is incredibly powerful. I think sometimes there's a temptation to have an argument about whether it should be randomized controlled trials or real world data. I think it's really important to take the two together. They are adjuncts to each other. Clinical trials will tell you about efficacy, while real world data will tell you about effectiveness. So if you take the example of real-time continuous glucose monitoring, we know that there is significant efficacy from the randomized controlled trials, but there's lovely real-world data confirming real-world effectiveness too. So they're an adjunct to each other, and you might see different effect sizes, and that's very important as well. In randomized controlled trials, we sometimes bring people up to the clinical research facility once a month or with a similar frequency, and that doesn't reflect usual clinical care. So you can get the skewing of the influence of observation. And in real world trials, you can have a much larger population without that skew from being observed in a randomized controlled trial that you have consented to. So you can have this large, diverse, representative population, though it's then challenging because you may not be able to collect quite as much data, but you can certainly have an accurate cost effectiveness analysis from a large population that tells you much more about how something would work if you rolled it out across a whole population in a country, for example. So they're really important to look at. They're important to look at in context. They need to be adjuncts to the clinical trial data, but they can really enrich the story for a technology.
Definitely. And I mean, I think you've already touched upon some pretty prominent advantages there. But are there any others you think are valuable to share?
Yeah, absolutely. So clinical trials, randomized control trials can be very expensive to undertake. They need lots of monitoring. They need lots of people to deliver the studies. So they can be very expensive. That's not necessarily a bad thing. They remain important to do, and it remains an important investment for clinical science. But real world data can give you much better value for money because they're much lighter touch and can often be undertaken remotely. So you can enroll a large population at a reasonably lower cost with a representative cohort, and you can include really long term follow up. Clinical trials will have an end date, they'll have a primary outcome date, and sometimes that's 3 or 6 or 12 months. So in the lifespan of someone living with diabetes, that's a really short time. But if you collect real-world data over 5 to 10 years, that can tell you much more about the evolution of things like complications or glucose self-management. There's less regulatory structure in real-world studies, so they can be simpler and more rapid to set up. And the technology use is reflective of what happens in the real world. So in a clinical trial, you have to write a protocol that includes the education that you'll deliver at the start of a technology use. But if you take real world data, particularly for things like glucose sensors, these are off the shelf devices. People can go on a website and buy a continuous glucose monitor and just start using it. And it's really interesting to see if that has a differential in terms of how effective it is. You don't get the confounding of that frequent contact with study teams. And you can do things like linkage to large electronic data collections. And a lovely example of that would be the National Diabetes Audit data that we have in England and Wales that tells us a huge amount about things like the progression of complications, how many people have the care processes that are required as part of diabetes care. So you can have massive advantages by tapping into the real world data. And as I said, really enriching that story about how a technology works at a population level.
It certainly seems like there's a lot of positives to using real world data. So I'm sure it will be applied more often. But I suppose as with anything, there must be a flip side. Are there any problems which you think need to be highlighted?
Yeah, nothing's perfect, is it? And real world data have huge power, but they must be taken in context and you need to be slightly careful about interpreting them. They're limited by what people feel is routine care. So what I do in my clinic might be different from what somebody does even a few miles down the road. So there is a limitation that routine care is not standardized. And one of the big problems that we've seen with glucose sensing real world data is that we sometimes don't have reliable baseline data. So there are some lovely data that show how things change once you start a technology, but don't necessarily tell you what the absolute baseline for that population is. So it's very difficult to know what the change has been over time. People are lost to follow up in real world studies because you haven't enrolled them and don't necessarily have all of their details. There is inevitable attrition of data collection down the line. And because your outcomes are not time bound, so for example, in a clinical study, you might say we're going to collect an HbA1c outcome at 3 months, but we don't have the opportunity to do that rigidly in a real world data set. So the outcomes might be a little bit less clearly defined in terms of a time bound way. There's the risk of some clinician bias in how we manage people. So if we know that we're collecting data for a real-world study, we might slightly change how we manage things. And in terms of how the data are looked at, if you take real-world data to NICE, for example, they may feel that they're of lower quality and sit below randomized controlled trial data in how they're prioritized for access to technologies or medications. So it can be difficult to use real world data to really change practice. And the other thing that's hard to do is that you can't do things like head-to-head studies. So I told you about three studies that were head-to-head studies of flash and real-time glucose monitoring. It's really difficult to do that from real world data because it's very hard to match a population and see what the differences are in terms of effectiveness. So there are some limitations. And as I said, I think the important thing is that you take real world and randomized controlled trial data and you use them together to tell a story.
Yeah, everything does have its limitations. And if we do combine them, that'll be really beneficial. So we discussed earlier the evidence base that existed for these clinical trials. So how about this real world data? What evidence base is here for glucose sensing technologies?
There's a few. And if we think again about real-time continuous glucose monitoring, there's the RESCUE study, which was very, very detailed and confirmed the randomized controlled trial data for the glucose signals of improved overall control and reduced exposure to hypoglycemia. But because it was real-world data, it was also able to tell us about work absenteeism and hospital admissions. And these are not things that are always routinely collected in randomized controlled trial data. And showed very nicely that real-time continuous glucose monitoring means that people are able to work more often and have fewer hospital admissions. And these are really important, not just for the individual, but they have really large impacts on cost effectiveness. So work absenteeism and productivity are really important, particularly for people who are self-employed. And obviously hospital admissions are critically important to the person living with diabetes, but are also really important to the healthcare system, because if you can reduce bed use, that reduces costs and burden on a healthcare system. The Commissaire study, as I said earlier, one of the benefits of real-world data is that you can do it for longer. And the Commissaire study is a real-time continuous glucose monitoring, long-term follow-up study over 3 years, which is significantly longer than any of the randomized controlled trial data. And then we have manufacturer data. So often with devices, the manufacturer themselves collect lots of data and are able to collate that and publish it. And the data for the Dexcom G6 device shows that the urgent low soon alert, which is the only urgent predictive hypoglycemia alert, shows that there is a real impact in the real world of using that in reducing exposure to hypoglycemia. So that tells us not just about the device itself, but about the feature use. So all of these devices have lots of features that you can turn on and off. And it's really nice to see a well-conducted real-world study that tells us that those features, those advanced features, can be really helpful. In terms of real-world studies of flash glucose monitoring, there's the Future study, which is a national registry, and showed a stable HbA1c, as with the randomized controlled trial data. But again, importantly, reduced work absenteeism and reduced severe hypoglycemia. So these are really important outcomes for the people living with diabetes. In the UK, we have the ABCD, the Association of British Clinical Diabetologists, which collected real-world data for flash use. And that this is an example of where there was really high attrition of follow-up. So it started off with a large number of people, and that was slowly whittled down over time, which means that the real-world data that are published at the end point are at risk of selection bias, and that's one of the disadvantages of real world data. The Swedish registry, on the other hand, is another national registry which showed a small HbA1c reduction in people who were above target who used flash glucose monitoring, and again a signal of reduced severe hypoglycemia. And severe hypoglycemia is a really important outcome for the person, but it's also really important from a clinical study point of view because it's a relatively rare event. It's really hard to power a study, a randomized controlled study, to show a reduction in severe hypoglycemia. So being able to look at it robustly in a national registry for real world data is really impactful. Similarly, the Scottish data, again, another national registry, showed a reduction in HbA1c and diabetic ketoacidosis, but highlights the socioeconomic inequality and access of flash, but not outcomes. So it showed that people from more deprived areas were less likely to access flash glucose monitoring, certainly at the start, but weren't exactly able to achieve the same outcomes as people from lower deprivation areas. So what we should really be trying to do here is address health inequalities, and it's these sorts of findings that you wouldn't be able to get from randomized controlled trials. And finally, there's a European analysis of data, and this is a huge data set, but no baseline data. So we can only look at associations over time. So there's loads of data there. They all have slight weaknesses, but taken as a whole on top of the randomized controlled trial data really confirms what we found and tells us where the benefits lie of each of the technologies.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's really important that you did highlight that there are still some limitations. But I think the overarching theme is that we're really seeing the evidence base grow and become established in the real world data setting. So what comes next? What is next in the real world data space?
So certainly in type 1 diabetes, one of the things that we're starting to see, which is fantastic, is the real world studies of automated insulin delivery. So hybrid closed loop systems that use a continuous glucose sensor connected to an insulin pump to automatically adjust insulin delivery, and certainly basal insulin delivery. There are some very large studies of highly advanced technologies, and these measure in the thousands of patient years, which is hugely impactful and something that would be so difficult and expensive to do in a randomized controlled trial environment. And these confirm exactly what we'd expect from the randomized controlled trial data of automated insulin delivery, that the overall glucose and particularly exposure to higher glucose above target is significantly improved by automated insulin delivery. And the other thing about real-world data and what comes next is that, unlike drugs to a certain extent, there is a very rapid turnover of technologies. So product cycles are much more akin to mobile phone, iPhone product cycles than they are with drugs. So we tend to have a new continuous glucose monitoring technology every year or two, whereas we get a new class of drugs much less frequently than that. So real-world data can jump onto a new device very quickly and can give us a much more rapid turnover of an evidence base that builds on previous data. And I think the next thing that we'll see is embedding CGM and continuous glucose technologies into routine data reporting for rapid dissemination. And a lovely example of where that happens happened, albeit outside of continuous glucose sensing data, is in the National Diabetes Audit COVID data, which managed to very rapidly publish data for people living with diabetes who developed COVID both in and out of hospital and showed morbidity and mortality from that. And that's such an important way to use real world data to really populate a national evidence base in a really highly impactful way.
Yeah, that's such a fantastic example of how it's actually been used in the real world to make real change. So yeah, thanks so much, Nick. This has really been a valuable discussion, and I am sure that there'll be far more to discuss about this in the coming years as this technology develops and more data comes out. So I just wondered if you had any final words on the matter that you'd like to discuss.
I think the summary is that real-world data can be hugely powerful and impactful. They're an adjunct to clinical trial data, which needs to tell us about effectiveness before we can build on efficacy. But they are hugely impactful. They enrich and tell the story beautifully sometimes. And particularly when done well, I think there's a temptation with real-world data to just collect what we have. But just like a good clinical study, good real-world data needs to be carefully designed and collated, but it can be incredibly powerful. And I think what we're going to see over the coming years is increasing use of glucose sensing data in the real world with linkage to real-world outcomes for people living with diabetes. And we'll start to get a really carefully drawn picture of the impact of continuous glucose sensing technologies as they become standard of care for everyone living with type 1 diabetes and for the majority of people living with type 2 diabetes, certainly those people who are insulin treated.
That's a fantastic summary. Thank you so much, Nick. And I really look forward to seeing these barriers to patients lowered so everyone can access these technologies, which I'm sure we'll see as years go on. But yeah, thank you so much again for being here. It's been such an interesting topic, and I really value your time. And I hope everyone joins again for future podcasts.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Nick.
You are listening to an ADIS podcast. You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS podcast with your preferred podcast provider or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements, please read the article on the journal website.